So, before we jump into the wreckage today, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 79 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. You can check it out at certfuel.com. So anyway, imagine handing over like $100 million for a company,
Yeah.
only to find out their flagship product, I don't know, spontaneously combusts the minute it hits 15 miles per hour. That is not some wild hypothetical.
Well, it's really not.
That is exactly the kind of nightmare scenario that happens when due diligence fails. So today we are pulling from a massive stack of sources. We've got Series 79 study guides, raw SEC regulations, FFine and ARI exam outlines. We're trying to figure out how the financial world actually prevents those, $100 million
Right,
disasters.
because it's so different from buying something normal.
Exactly. Normally, when we talk about buying something, there's a baseline expectation of transparency, right? You go to buy a used car, you pop the hood, you check the Carfax, and the salesperson points and says, look, four wheels and an engine. It's tangible.
It's physical and it's binary. The engine either turns over or it catches fire. We naturally crave that kind of visible, categorizable reality.
Right. But then you step into the world of mergers and acquisitions, M&A, and suddenly you're not buying a machine. You are buying this living, breathing, incredibly murky corporate ecosystem. And that brings us to our mission for this deep dive, which is dominating the due diligence or DD section of the Series 79 exam. And we are throwing out dry memorization today. To actually pass this exam, especially for those of us whose eyes just glaze over at textbook definitions, we have to deeply understand the why of M&A due diligence.
Which I mean, that's the only way to actually retain the material. If you understand the human motivations and the literal legal terrors driving these rules, you don't have to memorize 100 isolated bullet points. The answers just become intuitively obvious.
And to make those human motivations crystal clear, we are bringing in a recurring cast of characters for this.
I love this.
First, we have Slippery Steve. He's the founder and CEO of Steve Suspicious Scooters. He is our target, the seller.
A founder whose business model is, let's call it only slightly more chaotic than his accounting practices.
That is putting it mildly. And on the other side of the negotiating table, we have Cautious Chloe. She is the CEO of a massive, heavily regulated transit conglomerate. She's our buyer. And stuck right in the middle, trying to keep literally everyone out of jail, is Banker Bob.
Poor Banker Bob.
He's the chronically exhausted investment banker who works on both sides of the street, depending on our scenario.
Yeah, he's just running on pure caffeine and legal anxiety at this point.
He really is. But before Bob can even think about sleeping, he has to run a massive due diligence process. And I actually have to push back on this right out of the gate. Why do bankers even do DD? I mean, the buyer has their own lawyers, they have accountants. Is Banker Bob just running up billable hours? Like, is the bank just trying to be annoying to Slippery Steve?
I hear that frustration a lot,
Awesome.
especially from founders going through the process for the first time. It feels like an endless administrative nightmare to them.
Yeah.
But due diligence serves two really essential purposes.
Okay.
First, it protects buyers like Cautious Chloe from absorbing massive hidden liabilities that she didn't factor into her purchase price. But more importantly for the exam, it protects Banker Bob and his underwriting firm from catastrophic securities liability.
Wow.
If a bank underwrites a deal and the offering documents turn out to be just full of lies, Bob's firm goes down with the ship. They are on the hook.
So it's less about being annoying and more about literally building a legal shield.
Yeah, that shield is the only thing keeping Bob out of federal court. And that shield is forged directly in the fires of the Securities Act of 1933.
Let's use that as our anchor then, the disclosure standard. This is the absolute foundation of liability for these bankers. So, what does the Securities Act actually say about civil liability for public offering registration statements?
The regulatory standard has two prongs, and they carry equal weight. When Bob prepares offering documents, those documents cannot contain an untrue statement of material fact or
So,
omit a material fact necessary to keep the statements from being misleading.
okay, let me try an analogy to separate those two prongs because they sound similar. Let's say I'm selling you a house. If I look you dead in the eye and say, the roof is brand new, but the roof is actually 30 years old and actively caving in, that is an untrue statement of material fact. I just lied to your face.
Right, that's the straightforward one. It's affirmative fraud.
But the second prong is the sneaky one. Let's say the roof is perfectly fine, but I conveniently forget to mention that there is a literal level 5 poltergeist living in the attic. Have I made an untrue statement? Technically, no. I never actually said the attic was ghost-free, but I have omitted a material fact that makes the rest of my, you know, this is the lovely, peaceful home sales pitch, incredibly misleading.
Exactly. And both the fake roof and the secret poltergeist get you sued into oblivion under the Securities Act. Yeah. The exam constantly tests that OR. It's not just about the lies you tell. It's about the truths you hide.
Right.
If Slippery Steve says, you know, our scooter sales are up 50% year over year, but intentionally omits the fact that the scooters spontaneously combust when they hit 15 miles per hour, that omission makes the sales figure wildly misleading.
Cautious Chloe is going to be furious, and Banker Bob is getting sued. Now, I want to throw up a giant exam trap flag right here. Listeners, pay attention. We are talking about the liability standard for public offering registration statements. But what if Slippery Steve is raising money privately? What about private offering memoranda, like PPMs? Do they have the exact same standard?
The exam writers will absolutely try to trick you into applying that specific Securities Act registration statement liability to private offerings. But private offering memoranda, those PTMs, they are not subject to this specific standard just because they are offering documents.
Oh, wait, does that mean Slippery Steve can just openly lie in a private offering? That can't be right.
No, he absolutely cannot lie. But the legal mechanism is different. Private offerings fall under different general anti-fraud rules, primarily under the Exchange Act of 1934. The reason for the distinction is that public registration statements are heavily regulated documents. They're filed with the SEC for everyday retail investors. So the regulatory burden is at its absolute highest. Private offerings are typically for wealthy, sophisticated institutions who are expected to fend for themselves a bit more. So from a strict regulatory definition standpoint on the test, just do not collapse the two liability standards into one.
Okay, so they're separate. So Banker Bob is terrified of the poltergeist in the attic. He's terrified of the combusting scooters. When the lawsuit inevitably comes, how does he defend himself?
He invokes the reasonable investigation defense. Bob has to prove to a judge that his investigation into Steve's company was robust and reasonable. But here is the catch. What is considered reasonable sits on a sliding scale.
A sliding scale.
Yeah.
So wait, Bob doesn't have a universal SEC checklist he can just print out and follow.
There is no universal checklist, and that is another common exam distractor. Yeah, the level of digging required depends on the type of issuer, the type of security, and the underwriting arrangement. Think about the risk profile. If Banker Bob is taking Slippery Steve's company public for the very first time, like an IPO for a first-time issuer, Steve is a complete unknown. Bob has to rip up the floorboards and check every single corner of that business.
But if Bob is doing a follow-on offering for a company like, I don't know, Apple or Microsoft?
The required depth is significantly lighter. Apple has armies of analysts. They have historical public filings, a massive track record. It's the same legal standard, but a very different practical depth of investigation.
Okay, that makes intuitive sense.
Thank you.
But even without a universal checklist, the Series 79 outline gives us six specific categories of DD review that Banker Bob has to hit. Let's walk through them and let's figure out why he's actually doing them.
Sure. So the first is financials. This is the baseline. Bob is looking at historical performance, future projections, and the debt structure. He's trying to see if the math actually works.
Right.
The second is the business plan. Is Steve's strategy viable in the current market, or is he, you know, projecting growth in an industry that's actively dying?
Uh-huh. And then third, Bob has to actually talk to people.
Yeah.
Management interviews. He has to sit down with Slippery Steve and look for inconsistencies in his story. But management is always going to spin things, right? So where does Bob go for the actual unfiltered truth?
That brings us to the fourth category, which is third-party interviews. And this is a critical distinction. We are not just talking about interviewing the target's employees.
Mm.
We are talking about vendors, suppliers, and customers.
So Bob can't just ask C's chief mechanic if the scooters are good. He has to actually call the factory in Taiwan that's supplying the wheels to see if Steve is, I don't know, actually paying his bills on time.
Exactly. Independent corroboration is literally the only way to pierce the reality distortion field of a founder.
Right.
And then fifth is site visits. Bob cannot just look at a spreadsheet. He has to physically go to the scooter warehouse and verify that it isn't just an empty dirt lot in Nevada.
Got to make sure the scooters actually exist. Okay, listener, pause for a second. I want to ask you a direct question. Think about this before I answer. What is bring down due diligence? Is it when the banker uses negative findings to negotiate the purchase price down? Give it a beat? Nope. It has absolutely nothing to do with price negotiations.
Bring down DD is the pre-closing refresh. It is the process of bringing the due diligence record down to the present moment, right up to the closing date.
But why is that necessary? If Bob did a massive investigation in January, isn't he just good to go?
Well, deals take a long time to close. If the ink doesn't dry until June, Bob can't just cross his fingers and assume everything stayed exactly the same for 6 months.
Right.
What if the Taiwan factory burned down in April? What if Steve lost his biggest customer in May? The bring down review ensures the DD record remains accurate right up to the literal moment the money changes hands. No new poltergeists have moved into the attic.
Okay, we have the foundational legal rules. Let's see how this actually plays out on the battlefield. I want to look at the sell side process first. We are playing defense. Banker Bob is representing Slippery Steve, trying to sell his scooter company. How does this process actually kick off?
The entire process starts with the internal review. Before Cautious Chloe or any other potential buyer even gets a glimpse of the company's inner workings, Banker Bob investigates Steve's company himself.
Wait, Bob investigates his own client? The guy paying his fee, why waste the time?
Because you have to find the skeletons in the closet before the buyer does. Think of it as a dress rehearsal for the real audit. If Bob discovers during his internal review that Steve's scooters have a, you know, faulty braking system, they have options. They can fix it, they can frame the narrative, or they can clearly disclose it up front.
It's like checking your teeth for spinach before you go on a first date. You don't want to wait for your date to point it out over dessert.
Right, because if Cautious Chloe finds the spinach on her own 3 months into negotiations, she loses trust immediately. She will use that discovery to chip away at the purchase price, or she might just walk away from the deal entirely.
Wow.
They're saying when the seller discloses a problem, it's transparency. When the buyer discovers a problem, it's a cover-up.
Oh, man, that is a crucial distinction. Okay, so Bob finds the spinach. He cleans up the financials, gets everything ready. That physical preparation takes the form of the VDR, the virtual data room.
Yeah, the data room is the secure, permissioned online repository where all the sensitive due diligence documents live. Contracts, patents, employee records, literally everything.
Now, here is where it gets incredibly pedantic, but it is tested heavily on the exam. The seller's management and their lawyers source the actual documents. But Banker Bob's job is to index and package them within the VDR. Now, I have to push back on this. Indexing sounds like glorified filing. Why is this a testable, high-level concept for an investment banker?
Because that index is not just a table of contents. It is the seller's ultimate legal fortress.
Walk me through how that works in practice.
Okay, let's say a year after the acquisition closes, Cautious Chloe sues Steve. She claims Steve never told her about a massive pending lawsuit from a customer who crashed a scooter. If Banker Bob properly built and indexed that data room, he doesn't just argue with her. He pulls the access log and says, actually, Chloe, that specific lawsuit was uploaded into folder 4, subfolder B, document 12. And our cryptographic logs show that your lead attorney opened that exact document on a Tuesday at 4:00 p.m.
Oh, my gosh.
It is irrefutable proof of exactly what was disclosed and when.
Wow. So it completely neutralizes the whole you hid this from me argument.
And it serves a dual purpose, too. It's also an incredible intelligence gathering tool.
Right.
Bob is sitting
right
behind the scenes watching those access logs in real time.
Right.
If he sees that Cautious Chloe's team is spending 90% of their time aggressively downloading and analyzing folders related to intellectual property, Bob knows exactly what Chloe values most about the deal. Or, conversely, where she sees the most risk.
That is brilliant. It's like selling a house and being able to watch a heat map of where the home inspector is standing.
Exactly.
If he's in the basement for 3 hours, you know the foundation negotiation is coming.
It allows the sell side to anticipate the buyer's negotiation strategy before they even get to the table.
Okay, listener, are you ready? Peel, ot, twist.
You're trying to give me a heart attack?
Yeah, got to keep the ADHD brain engaged. Here's the plot twist. Slippery Steve isn't the only one under the microscope. While Chloe is digging through Steve's data room, Banker Bob is actually running a shadow investigation on Cautious Chloe.
Yes, this is a concept called reverse due diligence.
Reverse DD, investigating the buyer. But why? If Chloe is offering $100 million for the scooter company, why does Steve care if she has spinach in her teeth? Just take the check.
Because in the M&A world, an offer letter is just a worthless piece of paper until the wire transfer actually clears. The entire goal of reverse DD is to confirm the buyer's ability and willingness to close the transaction.
Ability and willingness. Let's break those down.
Okay, so ability means capital and clearance. Does Chloe actually have $100 million in cash? Or is she relying on highly speculative junk bond financing that might fall through if the market blips? And what about regulatory clearance? Chloe runs a massive transit conglomerate. If she tries to buy a scooter company, is the Department of Justice going to step in and block the merger for antitrust reasons?
Right, and willingness is about reputation. Does Chloe have a notorious history of dragging out due diligence for 6 months, only to wait until the day before closing to suddenly demand a 20% discount? Because if she is a chronic price retreater, Bob needs to warn Steve not to sign exclusivity with her.
And this raises a massive trap for the Series 79 exam. The question will try to trick you into thinking that reverse DD is about the seller trying to extract the highest theoretical purchase price.
Oh.
It is not. It is a sell-side function aimed squarely at closing certainty.
Closing certainty. Let me repeat that. Closing certainty. Slippery Steve would much rather take a rock-solid, fully funded $90 million offer from a buyer who will definitely close than a flimsy $100 million offer from a buyer who might flake at the last minute and leave his company, you know, damaged in the market.
That is the core philosophy of reverse DD.
Okay, let's flip the script entirely. Let's look at the buy-side process. We are playing offense now. Banker Bob has switched teams, and now he represents cautious Chloe.
In this defensive-to-offensive shift, Bob goes from being a shield builder to acting as an air traffic controller. He has to coordinate an incredibly complex schedule between Chloe's army of accountants, lawyers, and environmental consultants, and Steve's target company.
Right, because Chloe can't just drop 50 auditors into Steve's warehouse unannounced on a Tuesday.
Right.
Bob has to schedule the management presentations, he manages the data room access requests, and he coordinates the site visits. But beyond scheduling, there are six substantive buy-side DD areas that Bob has to facilitate. And these go way beyond just verifying the balance sheet.
The exam absolutely expects you to understand the non-financial impact of these six areas.
Do it.
Let's unpack them. The first is HR and benefits.
Why does an investment banker care about the HR department?
Because of post-close transition risks. What happens to Steve's employees on day one of Chloe's ownership? How are they paid? What happens to their accrued vacation? If you botch the HR integration, you could trigger a mass exodus of key talent or literally a worker strike on your very first day running the company.
Man. Okay, area two, negotiating positions.
This is weaponizing your DD findings. If Bob's team discovers that Steve's scooter inventory is mostly obsolete models that won't sell, Bob uses that specific finding to aggressively negotiate a lower price when they draft the final term sheet.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Area three, leadership evaluation.
When you buy a company, you are often buying its management team. Can you actually trust the people running this place? This involves comprehensive background checks on the key executives.
Okay, pause again. Direct question for the listener. Think carefully. If cautious Chloe orders a background check during the DD process, is she running it on her own executive team to prove they are clean, or is she running it on Slippery Steve's team? Give it a beat. She is running it strictly on the target leadership. The buy side checks the target. Chloe already knows her own people. She needs to uncover if Slippery Steve has a hidden history of securities fraud or, you know, personal bankruptcies before she gives him a board seat.
Under exam stress, people second guess that and get it backward. Always remember the flow of investigation.
Right.
Area four is culture, governance, and labor. And this might be the most destructive area if ignored.
Give me a real world example of why culture matters to bankers.
Look at the AOL and Time Warner merger in the early 2000s. It was heralded as the ultimate synergy of new media and traditional media, but the cultures were violently incompatible. AOL was this aggressive, arrogant tech culture. Time Warner was a buttoned-up traditional corporate culture.
Yeah.
They hated each other. They couldn't integrate their systems. Their teams literally refused to collaborate, and it destroyed billions of dollars in shareholder value. Buy-side DD has to ask, can Chloe's rigid transit employees actually merge with Steve's chaotic scooter gang?
If the answer is no, the math doesn't even matter.
Exactly.
Okay, area five, risk discovery.
This is hunting for off-balance sheet items, unfunded liabilities.
Like what?
Let's say Slippery Steve promised a lavish, secret lifetime health plan to his first 10 scooter mechanics to keep them from quitting, but he never actually funded a trust for it, and it's buried in a side contract, not clearly on the balance sheet.
Oh, boy.
Buy-side DD has to surface that hidden risk, because once Chloe buys the company, she is legally on the hook to pay for it.
And finally, area six, cost-saving opportunities.
Oh.
Or, as the corporate world loves to call them, synergies.
When Chloe buys Steve's company, she is almost certainly paying a premium over its current standalone value. To justify paying that premium to her own shareholders, Bob has to find ways the combined company will save money. If they merge, can they shut down Steve's expensive headquarters and move everyone into Chloe's building? Can they fire duplicate middle management?
Right.
Can they use their massive combined purchasing power to force the Taiwan factory to lower wheel prices by 10%?
Finding the money to make the math work. So that's the six areas. But here's a structural problem. Banker Bob can't just sit in his office looking at the data room that Slippery Steve curated, right?
No, if he does, he's basically failing his client. The FanFinery outline explicitly tests a concept called sourcing outside the target.
Because the data room is a highly sanitized narrative. It is exactly what Slippery Steve wants you to see. Independent sources are the things he cannot control.
Precisely. If Steve's data room paints a picture of a beloved brand dominating the market, Bob needs to step outside that room. He needs to read trade press and industry publications to see what competitors are actually saying. He needs to check the SEC's EDGR database.
Let's clarify EDGR real quick for anyone who hasn't stared at it for hours. That's the Electronic Data Gathering Analysis and Retrieval System. It's the SEC's public database where all official corporate filings live.
Right. You check EDGR to see what they've been telling the government, which might differ from what they are telling you in the data room.
Oh.
Bob also needs to search public court dockets to see if Steve is quietly fighting off consumer lawsuits. And if the auction rules permit it, he should make reference calls to Steve's actual customers to see if they actually like the scooters.
It's the whole trust but verify model.
No.
Or in Slippery Steve's case, distrust and verify.
Yeah. When the sanitized narrative of the data room and the messy reality of independent sources diverge, that gap is exactly where Banker Bob needs to aim his investigation.
Okay, I want to take a breath here and do a side-by-side showdown. Because the absolute most common exam trap is mixing up which side does what. The concepts sound similar, but the motivations are totally flipped depending on who Bob actually represents. Let's do a rapid-fire comparison.
Yeah, I'm ready.
First rule of the showdown, verbs matter. When it comes to the virtual data room, what does the sell side do?
The sell side builds, indexes, and hosts. They construct the fortress.
And the buy side?
The buy side consumes, queries, and inspects. They try to breach the fortress.
Who owns the physical schedule? Who is the air traffic controller for management presentations and site visits?
The buy side banker coordinates the schedule with the buyer and the target. The sell side helps prepare the seller to perform, but the buy side is the one deploying their army of inspectors and demanding access.
What about cost savings and synergies? Which side cares about those?
Purely buy side. Think about it logically. Slippery Steve already runs the business. He doesn't need to invent synergies to justify his own daily existence. Chloe is the one writing a massive check, so she needs the synergies to justify the premium she's paying.
Risk discovery. Finding the secret retiree health plans.
Both sides care, but their reactions are opposite. The buy side surfaces risks. They aggressively hunt for them to drive the purchase price down. The sell side mitigates risks. They try to find them first so they can fix them and spin them before the buyer asks.
Background checks on management.
Purely buy side, the buyer investigating the target's leadership.
And reverse DD.
Purely sell side, the seller investigating the buyer to ensure they actually have the cash and regulatory clearance to close the deal.
Okay, if you keep those verbs and human motivation straight, you will crush the side-by-side questions on the Series 79. Now let's crank the difficulty dial up a bit. Everything we've talked about assumes Steve's suspicious scooters is a private company. What happens if Steve took his company public 3 years ago?
If the target is a public company, the regulatory landscape shifts dramatically. We enter the realm of Sarbanes-Oxley, specifically SOX Title IV Enhanced Financial Disclosures. And this creates three massive DD checkpoints for Banker Bob.
Let's give some quick context for SOX because it's important. Sarbanes-Oxley wasn't just invented to torture bankers. It was born out of the ashes of the Enron and WorldCom scandals in the early 2000s, where executives were just running rampant accounting frauds and treating public companies like their personal fiefdoms. So SOX was designed to put a leash on executives.
Yeah.
Let's look at checkpoint one, the personal loan prohibition. Let's say Slippery Steve, as the CEO of a public company, wants a $2 million loan from his company's treasury to buy a solid gold jet ski. He even signs a rock-solid contract promising to pay the company above market interest rates. Can he do that?
That is absolutely illegal under SOX. Public issuers are strictly prohibited from extending personal loans to their directors or executive officers, full stop.
But wait, he said he'd pay above market rates. He's He's over-collateralizing it. It's a great return on investment for the company's cash.
And that argument right there is the exact trap the exam will set for you. The question will try to distract you with phrases like market terms or favorable interest rates or highly collateralized. None of that matters. The underlying relationship itself is banned.
Why? Why not let them do it if the terms are genuinely good?
Because before SOX, executives were using the corporate treasury as a personal piggy bank to hide compensation from shareholders and evade taxes. The conflict of interest is just too high, so Congress banned the mechanism entirely.
So as a DD hook, if Bob is investigating Steve's public company, where does he look to find these illegal jet ski loans?
He scrubs the related party transaction footnotes in the financial statements. If he finds a loan to an officer, it's a massive regulatory violation that could completely derail the deal.
Got it. Okay, checkpoint two, accelerated insider reporting, specifically the Form 4. This is the form insiders have to file with the SEC when they change their ownership stake.
Right. When a CEO, director, or major shareholder buys or sells shares of their own company's stock on the open market.
Direct question for the listener. Get ready. Slippery Steve decides to dump 10,000 shares of his own company on a Friday afternoon. When is his Form 4 legally due to the SEC? Give it a beat. It is due in 2 business days from the transaction date. So the trade executes on Friday. Monday is business day 1. Tuesday is business day 2. The form must be filed by Tuesday.
That 2-day window is a heavily tested point. The exam loves to test this by offering you the old pre-SOX rule as a multiple choice option. Before SOX, executives didn't have to report the trade until the 10th day of the following month.
That's insane. Yeah. So if Steve sold his stock on May 1st, he wouldn't have to tell the public until Juneteenth.
Exactly. It gave insiders a massive head start to quietly dump their shares before bad news hit the market, while retail investors were completely in the dark.
Wow.
SOX closed that window to 2 business days because inside trades signal vital information about a company's health. The public needs to know immediately if the captain is fleeing the ship.
The exam will also try to trick you by saying the deadline is 2 days from the settlement date.
Yeah.
No, it is the transaction date. The moment the trade executes, the clock starts ticking.
That is a critical distinction. The SEC cares when the decision was executed, not when the back office clearing paperwork settles.
Okay, checkpoint three. The internal control requirement, or ICFR. This stands for internal control over financial reporting, which sounds like literally the most boring phrase in the English language.
It sounds incredibly dry, but it is the actual heartbeat of corporate trust. ICFR is basically asking, can this company actually count its own money accurately? Do they have systems in place to prevent Steve's accountants from just making numbers up?
Right.
SOX requires 2 dubio distinct assertions regarding these internal controls.
2 assertions. Who has to make them?
First, management's assessment. Slippery Steve, as CEO, has to sign a report legally swearing, we have tested our internal controls and they work. Second, the auditor's attestation. An independent outside accounting firm has to come in, test Steve's claim, and publish a report saying, yes, we agree management's controls are effective.
So it's not enough for Steve to just grade his own homework. The independent auditor has to co-sign the grade.
That's the general rule, but there is a major exception you absolutely need to know for the exam. Non-accelerated filers and emerging growth companies, which are essentially smaller or newer public companies, are legally exempt from the auditor attestation requirement.
Why do they get a pass?
Because forcing an outside auditing firm to rip apart a tiny company's internal systems costs millions of dollars. It would bankrupt small startups just trying to exist on the public markets, so they are exempt from paying for the auditor's attestation, but management still has to assess the controls themselves.
Okay, so what happens if Banker Bob is reading a target's 10K, and he sees a disclosure that says there is a material weakness in the internal controls?
That is a giant screaming red flag in the DD process. A material weakness means the internal systems are so fundamentally flawed that the financial statements might be complete fiction. You just cannot trust the numbers you are looking at.
And if cautious Chloe can't trust the numbers, she can't accurately price the deal.
It grinds the entire M&A process to a halt. You can't buy a house if you don't know how many rooms it actually has.
Okay, my brain is officially full of combusting scooters, attic poltergeists, and SEC forms. Let's do the ultimate rapid-fire exam brain dump. I'm going to throw out a concept. You give me the core takeaway to memorize for test day.
Let's do it.
Securities Act liability standard.
It triggers for untrue statements or material omissions. The omission of the truth is just as illegal as a lie.
Bring down DD.
It is a pre-closing refresh to ensure accuracy, not a price negotiation tool.
Reverse DD.
The sell side investigating the buyer strictly to ensure closing certainty.
Background checks and identifying cost-saving synergies.
Those are purely buy-side functions.
Form 4 reporting deadlines for insiders.
2 business days from the transaction date.
Personal loans to public company executives.
Banned completely. Promising market terms is a trap answer.
Incredible. We've mapped out the entire battlefield of due diligence. But before we let everyone get back to their study guides, I want to leave you with a thought that isn't explicitly in the textbook, but is fundamentally changing this industry right now. We spent this whole time talking about Banker Bob staying up for 72 hours manually digging through data rooms to find a hidden liability. But what happens to due diligence when Bob is replaced by an AI?
That is the frontier we are standing on. Law firms and banks are currently deploying large language models that can ingest a virtual data room with 10,000 contracts and cross-reference them for anomalies in 3 seconds.
Wow.
It eliminates the human error of a sleep-deprived banker missing a clause.
But does it eliminate the human intuition? Like, if Slippery Steve is sitting across the table sweating and dodging questions about his Taiwan factory, an AI can't read his body language,
yeah.
An AI doesn't smell a rat. As technology weaponizes the speed of due diligence, making it impossible to hide a bad contract, does the premium on human psychology actually go up? If the machines verify the math, maybe the banker's only job left is evaluating the actual soul of the deal.
That is a fascinating tension. The tools get sharper, but human deception is always evolving to beat the tools.
Definitely something to mull over while you're grinding through those practice questions. Huge thanks for walking us through this incredibly dense terrain. And to our listeners, keep crushing your studying. Remember to check out CertFeel.com for those practice exams to really lock these concepts in. Keep looking for the leverage, trust but verify everything, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.